Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that is amidst a wild and crazy World Cup. I'm one of your hosts, John Bruford, joined by your other host, who is hilariously located in the Netherlands, Fenton Costello. Fenton, hello.
Hello, John.
Is that slightly orangey t-shirt in solidarity with your fallen comrades in the Netherlands?
No.
Were you aware that there was a match on last night in the early hours of the morning?
I was aware that my son set his alarm clock for 3 a.m. to get up to watch the game and managed to sleep through it.
Good lad. That is quality. I respect that. So we're recording this on Tuesday, 30th of June. And so last night, two of the, you can't call them outright favorites, but two of the big tournament teams went out last night on penalty shootouts, which is frankly hilarious. Something we will come back to later on. I shouldn't be saying too much that it's hilarious because you wait and see. England will go out on fucking penalties to the Democratic Republic of Congo on Wednesday. That would be just my shitting luck, wouldn't it? So, Fenton, how are you?
Good. No complaints.
None. I've been looking through some general news headlines just before I started recording. I don't know if you want to comment on any of these. We had packed lunches every day for 10 years and retired at 40. I hope I never meet them because they sound really dull. Hollywood director jailed after scamming Netflix for 8 million.
Respect.
Yeah. This one is potentially a mammoth structure found in deep space challenges our understanding of the universe. And loveliest town in England is also a very underrated food destination. Any thoughts on that?
No strong opinions, John.
It's Ludlow, Fenton, my hometown. Yeah. And to call it an underrated food destination is just fucking stupid. It's incredibly famous as a food destination. It launched the UK's first dedicated food festival, for God's sakes. It's like, this journalist hasn't even used ChatGPT. Shame on you, Metro.
Wow. Okay.
Ariana Grande is sorry that she's been forced to postpone tour shows. Only three shows, to be fair, in New York and Boston. But it's headline news in a British newspaper.
Do you know who never postpones?
Hang on though, Fenton. This shows a wider malaise, right? One of the problems with media organizations constantly chasing efficiencies, shall we say, and the ruination of the traditional news structure means that all of the news outlets are relying more and more on news wires, which is why this story is appearing in a British newspaper, because let's face it, Ariana Grande postponing three shows for a perfectly legitimate reason, it's not really news to people living in the UK.
Not just news wires, but also PR teams.
Oh, well, we've seen that with the AI stuff that's been getting into the press. Shameful.
As you know, an investor in a PR company, if you'd like to appear in the news, it's entirely possible. I can introduce you to a great team who can make that happen and, you know, give you points.
We both know, though, that I should be kept far away from the news, don't we?
We do.
Good. I'm glad we're both aware of that. That's good. An investor in it. Is that what you do these days? Do you invest in stuff and you're like an advisor?
I've helped them out a few bit. Look, the lads do all the hard work. I don't really do much.
And you only employ men?
No, they've got a lady on the team too. Full diversity. But it's mostly blokes. Just the way it worked out. And yeah, really good team. And they do brilliant work.
Great. Well, that's really good news.
They're
so Ariana Grande.
They're actually nominated for an award tomorrow at the IGB.
Well, that's exciting.
I think so.
What's the award? Best Fenton Costello business, because there's a lot of competitors for that one.
No, I haven't got my own category yet.
Next year, Fenton.
The what's he done now category. No.
Yeah, mind you, by this time next year, I'm not even going to be confident of winning the Best Fenton Costello Podcast Award.
No.
another headline for you. 10 movies from 2016 that would never be made today. Is that just because they realized they were shite? I don't know. Oh, God, why would you? What? Yeah, this is a load of old shit. Arsenal, confident of making a transfer breakthrough. Are these keto dieters heading towards a cholesterol? I haven't gone through the actual headlines of an actual newspaper. This is like a digest thing that I found.
Thanks
BBC
for sharing.
Science Focus.
Are we...
This reactor works with no fuel. It could change the future of fission.
Do you know what else could change the future?
Using lead as a coolant.
For fuck's sake. Let me do an ad read.
But using lead as a coolant, Fenton, this is genius.
Who'd have thought?
Well, I don't know. I haven't read the story yet, but I'm excited. But finally, though, hang on. I've got to reject all of the cookies. GTA 6 is apparently shaping up to be a disaster for retailers.
Yeah, because it's digital downloads.
And yet the pre-orders are...
Even the physical one is just an empty box with a code. So,
pre-orders have hit 1 billion.
Yeah, not surprised.
Yeah, but that's the kind of thing that, you know, like, could save lots of jobs and stuff. Now, what do I know? So anyway, Fenton, what were you trying to get in there and say, oh, so-and-so does what?
I was trying to link one of your headlines to one of our lovely sponsors.
Well, that's why I was giving you the headlines. I was dangling cheese.
You talked over me. You shut me down. You went on to the next one.
No. The problem was your timing.
Really? That's a story of my life. Too soon.
We've all been there, Fenton. I say we've all been there. What I mean is you've been there before.
Do you know who's great at timing?
No, Fenton, who?
The wonderful people at OptiMove, who are able to get the right message in front of the right person at the right time. The inventors of positionless marketing.
Well, I like the sound of them.
The number one player solution, player engagement solution for iGaming and sports betting operators.
Wow.
Go to optimove.com, get the demo, tell them we sent you.
Yeah, because they give you like a month free.
They do.
And it's great for us because it you know makes them think that their marketing money is well spent, which it is.
These seamless links.
Yeah, it's like a snake chain.
Just like that.
Yeah, don't get your hair caught in those so much, do you? Well, I don't get my hair caught in much at all. Unless you rub it in my eyebrows.
The back hair.
Yeah, it doesn't count if it slipped down there. But that's great news, and I'm really glad that I could help lead you to that. Do you know what else I'm really glad I could lead you to, Fenton?
What's that, John?
I'm glad you asked. I wanted to share with you that today's episode is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International.
No way.
Yeah. Again? Yeah, GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based lottery and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. Yes, it's true. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. I know, right? If you would like to be led to more information, Fenton, visit GamingLabs.com.
GamingLabs.com.
And speaking of GamingLabs.com, do you know a place where you can often find Gaming Labs?
Would it be an IGB event? Or a world gaming event?
No, it would be a world gaming event. I've seen them at ICE in Barcelona. Yeah.
We're already talking about ICE?
Yeah. Well, IGBs, you know, happened.
It was great.
IGBs happened. And actually, do you know who I bumped into at the UNLV conference on risk and gambling? I bumped into Christy Eichelman, who's the, I think she's a marketing director at GLI.
Oh, cool. That's great.
Yeah, it's really nice because if I see Christy at ICE or something like that, we get to say hi, but we don't usually get to chat, which she probably prefers. But this time I managed to stop her for a chat. Christy, how are you? You know, all that kind of thing. It was good.
She's like, who the fuck are you?
what are you pretty doing much here? Yeah.
Are you in?
Security.
How did I end up sponsoring you? Like, what happened? That kind of thing.
Yeah, it's, oh, thanks for sponsoring the podcast. The what now? Security. And there's me. Taxi for Bruford. Good times. Yeah.
Talking of good times.
Good times.
We should introduce our guest.
Worldgaming.com for anybody who's interested in finding out a bit of Clarion. They've also just renewed for is it third year or fourth year? I think it's a fourth year.
Well, they paid you twice, so as long as they want.
Fintan, I haven't sorted that out yet. Oh, man. It's the last time I message you.
I'm so happy they paid us double. That's how good we are.
No, it wasn't that one. This is an invoice from earlier in the year that they've accidentally paid twice.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, it wasn't the sponsorship one.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, unfortunately. Would have been, hey! But, Fintan, do you know what else we're doing today?
We're talking to our lovely guest.
Yes, we are. Would you like to introduce him? I'm going to have a drink. Sponsorships are available. We've got glass sponsorship, forehead sponsorship, and Fintan's almost biannual haircut sponsorship.
So we have the lovely Matt, returning guest, friend of the podcast.
What the fuck just happened?
You said introduce the guest.
Yeah, but it was just that huge pause.
I couldn't remember which university he was working for, so I had to quickly open it up.
It's easy-ish to remember because it sounds made up.
It does sound made up. It does sound like one of those dodgy online universities where
I've got a degree from there.
I have a PhD. Dr. Costello to you. I bought my tokens.
I bought that cereal box. Mine had a Curacao gaming license in it. No, I'm just kidding.
Ooh.
Well, that's the old joke. Now it's an Anjouan gaming license.
Yeah, or what's Anjouan?
Hey, did you see that Curacao published their crypto framework?
I did. I haven't read it.
But I can't believe nobody's shouting about that from the rooftop. That's a big fucking deal.
I agree. But talking of big deals.
Yeah. What about Matt
from the American University of Washington, I want to say. Is that right, Matt? No?
Please. No.
I fucked it. Oh, shit. Edit.
So I'd like to...
Introduce yourself, Matt.
I'd like to point out a few things in the last minute and a half of Fintan talking. First, I am wearing the logo of my university, so that could have been his cue.
I can't see. I'm blind. I'm not wearing my glasses. I'm too vain.
But I thought the pause was coming from the fact that nobody ever knows how to say my last name, which is Bukovic. Oh, so I figured sure. He's like pausing going, how do I say this? Because everybody usually does.
I am the worst. And John will back this up.
So you're good there.
My lack of education really shines through when it comes to pronouncing difficult words. Because
it's not your lack of education. I'm the one with no education. You're educated at the butt.
Yeah, but like, cheated in every exam, every school, like, just fuck it, I'm not the one. Like, but you're extremely well read, John. Extremely well read.
I can read.
We call that street smarts in America.
Street smarts.
Let's not go too far.
The mean streets of Ludlow.
So it is American University. You are correct. It's American University. It is in Washington, D.C. But I will give you a pass because for the first 3 months in the fall when I was working here, my father referred to it as the University of Americas. And I told him, Dad, I'm not in a yacht race down in Bermuda competing for a cup. So I know, right? So it is a fair pass. But
it's
I not, will.
It's
I,
a fail. It's a fail. Market hard.
You know, but you know what? It actually, it's funny on a small segue. It actually goes to the point of our last month and a half here at the university. Our president is leaving to take on a chairmanship between two educational institutions, and our new president will be our business school's dean, who'll be taking over as interim president for the next year. And his big vision is rebranding and launching and telling the story of American University, and that is our marketing team's task. So your I don't know about this image is actually exactly what we're trying to do, is tell the DC story, because we've gone up in rankings for our MBA program, our business schools, our university. You know, we're doing a great job. Nobody knows who we are and where we're at. So we've spent the last sort of year kind of doing well, and now we're looking to tell the story. So I'm very excited about that. That'll be, aside from the 4 million other jobs and tasks that I'll be doing and the 90,000 games I'll be watching, trying to figure out how to tell the story of a small university in Northwest Washington, DC.
Brilliant. That's really nice.
The little university that could. So it's returning guest, which is,
friend of the pod. Yeah.
Always good. But I don't even know what that is. But we were due to record this a couple of weeks ago, but we couldn't due to executive constraints. Which is something you should probably invest in, Fintan, because I think it's apparently these are things that all executives are into.
Constraints? Like,
yeah.
It's like a bondage joke or something.
That's exactly what this is. Exactly what this is. Bit of Fintan Costello, PhD, American University, BDSM. That's how your next business card looks.
I'm not into pain. I'm a cuddler. I'm not into pain. Big spoon.
who puts the big spoons and the little spoons in the same drawer? Nobody does, Fintan. I'm all for segregating spoons, frankly. I've never understood that terminology.
But
Matt, so we were due to talk, I think, just before. For Royal Ascot, I think.
Yes.
And then we had a postponing it for executive constraints.
Executive constraints.
Or executive restraints. That works better. Yeah. I'd invest in those. What were we going to talk about regarding Ascot? Were you looking at, because I know you're like,
sorry to interrupt. I've got a question.
Come on then. Ask me.
We'll do a teacher thing, Fintan. Yes.
I've always pronounced it Ascot. You're pronouncing it Ascot. Is this like one of those weird English things where like the word's not pronounced as it's written?
No, I think Ascot can go either way.
But it is Ascot, isn't it? That is the right way to pronounce it.
I think if I was seeing somebody with the neckwear, I would call it an ascot. Have I just blown your mind?
Just neckwear called ascots. What's an ascot? It's a thing.
Okay.
To answer your question, the two things I wanted to mention were just a couple of very fun betting things that we saw at the race. But I also wanted to talk about the project we did for the Royal Ascot and the Kentucky Derby in my class this year, using AI and predictive models to try to see if the computer could make the proper selections for the horse race. Spoiler alert, we weren't right. But we were not.
If you were, that you wouldn't wrong. Be here.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's actually, that's funny. So to go all to tell the whole story, to go back, it was March 21st, and I'm at Laurel Park, Maryland Jockey Club in Maryland. And we're, you know, putting this little thing together. We did predictions for the first four races. Race one comes up, and the nine horse was an 8-1, I wouldn't say long shot, but definitely not the favorite, and ends up winning. We had the winner, we had the trifecta, the exacta, and the superfecta, and we were up $902 after the first race. So, you know, I'm with a bunch of students cranking stuff out on laptops. They just won $902. So there's, you know, three reactions. Reaction one, where's the nearest bar? Reaction two, can I quit my job? Reaction three, just like every gambler, let's go again. So a couple rules that did establish this. It was fictitious money. We were not allowed to actually do this. And the reason behind that is Maryland was very kind enough to let us use some of their software as we were going through parimutuel stuff. And when you start using gambling equipment and stuff, you sign 45 million things saying we're not going to do anything nefarious or put us in jail. So, of course, you know, the first thing happens. And when you're with a bunch of kids who have not followed the industry as closely as I have over the years, you immediately think, oh my God, I have solved, I have cracked the system. You know, everybody in gambling says, I've got a system. I've got roulette's the best one I love. I've got a roulette system, Matt. I'm going to be a billionaire. I'm like, okay, you just, that's fine. Donate to my political campaign down the line. We're good there. So that was just kind of a very comical moment. We did okay. The fourth race came, and of course, every one of our predictions were gone. But what it really was fun to do was take years of data. For the Derby, for example, for these races, you're looking at 3-4 years. For the Derby, you're looking at over 110, 120 years, and consolidate these databases into what we thought were strong statistical models. I know none of my students are going to have careers as horse race handicappers. You know, maybe I'll train the next one. That's probably not going to happen. But what I did get to teach them was how do you consolidate 100 years worth of data points into a spreadsheet to put a model together. And they can sit in job interviews and they can sit in conversations and talk with their employers of, I can do this with other types of data. So that was really fun. So we did that. We fine-tuned the model. We put all this, we put this 3-week plan together of, you know, here's our horses, here's our predictive stuff. We launch it on Tuesday before the Derby. We're super excited about it. And two of the horses that we picked scratched, and the whole thing got thrown out. So it's Friday morning and I'm like, just throw this thing in the garbage. The horse I picked, Commandment, actually ended up finishing second in the Belmont. So I did have a pretty decent horse. Nobody had, Golden Tempo, the winner, which was a long shot in the first or third leg. So it went to show us that, let's just say this, we got to go back to the drawing board. So where was the drawing board? That led us into Royal Ascot week, and we did pretty good on the favorites. We didn't have any of the long shots coming through. We did pretty good on the favorites, and statistical wise, our model actually was profitable and successfully picking, but only picked winners at very long odds or very short odds. So wasn't really financially wealthy yet, but it'll give us a chance to go back and do something again. So this is, in case you're curious, this is what we do at our university classrooms is look at statistical modeling around a sports, sort of sports betting and sports gambling world to kind of understand and learn that, and then hopefully apply that in future careers down the line.
Love it.
So it was fun.
Because obviously there's two parts to this, right? Mm-hmm. There's the modeling, and then there's the allocating the bets to the model, right?
That is where we had success. So what we did was we actually used three forms of with one of the advancements we're doing here at the university is really integrating AI into as many things as we can. So we fed into the model. Here's a fictitious bankroll. We used $1,000 for the Derby for races 8-12. And we allocated that bankroll. And I'll send you guys the write-up then if you want to post on the site and stuff. They can take a look at that and what that looks like. But essentially, it was allocating the bankroll. We did two models, which this is actually, I like to say this, I don't have that many bright ideas, but this was one that I was pretty proud of. We had two models. One was, hey, what's the best way to bet this money? Like, throw it out there. We want to bet this money. Here's $1,000. Here's our races we're betting. Go ahead and throw that through. Pretty classic. The second one that I was a little bit more proud of was don't necessarily put money on the likely outcome or the highest probability. Place wagers on what might be the highest value, or not a long shot, but a mid-level one that would be the most rewarding, if you will. That actually proved profitable for both the Kentucky Derby, the times we were at Laurel Park, and Ascot Week. And it was not so much trying to pick a winner, but it was allocating money into what would be a respectable long shot that could potentially turn profitable, or your second, third, or fourth horses that if the favorite doesn't run well, here's who we're kind of looking at for that success. And that was the second allocation. And we did quite well on that one.
That's cool. And I think that like from a professional gambling perspective, right, that bet allocation, Kelly criterion, that kind of stuff is actually a big part of the secret sauce. It's not just about predicting, you know, it's because you're not going to get 100% right.
It is. And that was kind of the point we were trying. There was two points we were trying to address. The first was, you know, teaching students modeling around, you know, you tell them to go model. One thing finance students like to do is earnings reports and when a company is going to release their earnings. Great. That's not that exciting. But go get them to predict the champions of the 64-68 field, the NCAA men's basketball tournament, the playoffs of hockey, horse racing. You get them excited about that. So it's part of it's about connecting the material to a topic that they're going to enjoy. But the second half of that is to actually show, you know, the gaming industry, people that want to do this professionally and that are, you know, very knee deep into it, that it's not just them looking at a piece of paper or looking at a form and saying this, this, and this. It's high-end statistical models, and this is across the board in what we see advantage players on slot machines, when we see poker players who are playing 8 to 10 hours on simulators to understand the odds of each one of the hands that are coming through, horse racing, sports betting models that I read 2 weeks ago in one of these articles that back in apparently 2005, there was this wind current coming up the coast of the United States from the Atlantic, and all outdoor stadiums had more wind than they traditionally do. So people were betting the under religiously because of the wind streams that were coming in stadiums like Virginia Tech, Virginia, your Penn States, your Rutgers, all the way down into Duke, and everybody that had an open air stadium. And they ran an algorithm and an analysis of that. So it's this world is not just taking a box and a square and saying, I like this, this, and this, or watching something on TV and go, he looks good, let's place money on that. We saw that. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but we saw that with the futures of the World Cup where people are just like, oh, I like Team USA, let's place that money. It's just so much more of a sophisticated world. And what I saw at the next conference in New York here in the States is now you have not only betting companies using AI and using advanced algorithms to put their odds out, but going up against AI tools and software to help with predictions. So it is literally not a man versus machine, but two computers duking it out over what's going to happen. And at the end of the day, my hope is because of the amount of money that's involved in this industry, because of how worldwide spread, it's just about knowledge in a classroom of explaining to people what goes on, how your industry might be connected to that, how advertising dollars are attached to this, and what's this whole big conglomerate machine that is in the billions now, both in revenue, both in tax, you know, implications, and in worldwide structure. And, you know, a lot of boring words there, but for somebody that's going to be entering the industry that has a sports connection, you'll be dealing with this for the next 10 years. And that's why I think, you know, my class filled up in the spring. I'm getting requests of, are you running this in 2027? I'm already signed up now. So I'm happy with it.
That's really cool. No, but look, it's so important to, you know, because you got the material, but then like, okay, let's bring this to life. And then the beauty of sports is there's always a sport or there's something to analyze. And it's such a data-rich environment. Being able to just tackle that is crucial. It's a brilliant skill.
Yep. It's a data-rich environment, and I say this a lot. Sports are one of the few things that just cut through everything. Sports doesn't have your race, your religion, your political affiliation, your background. It throws all that out, and it's just everybody comes together around one kind of entity. We have our School of Public Affairs over here that does analyzation of political data, and kids get in fights and arguments over like numbers from an election in like 1971. And I'm just sitting here like, guys, that's not happening again. That's 40, 50 years ago. Don't worry about that. Like, it's okay.
But who would your money be on if it did devolve into a fist fight?
all the SPA students that also are either student athletes or want to be lawyers. They're quite scrappy. So they're usually pretty good on that side. So anyways, I say all this to say that, you know, we're trying to teach with a medium that draws attention in a world that, there's so many avenues out there that are trying to gravitate towards your attention. So if I can teach you something in a 10-minute span around a concept that you like, I think I'm doing my job.
Yeah, you probably are.
Or, you know, we'll find out next year if I don't get my contract renewal. Then I'll come back on the show in March in 2027 and say, hey, guys, you got any work over here?
Now, I think by then you'll have tenure.
Year five. I'm on year two right now, so I got three to go, is the attack plan on that. But I will say we went from – when I talked to you guys last in February, we were kind of in this limbo world of where do we stand now. The program has now grown to 15 – we have a 15-credit coursework. So for educational structure, it's five classes. I have 90 students currently enrolled altogether in those classes with cohorts of 38 to 43 students that are fully invested in that. We've done 8 different mega event trips. We're coming to London in 2027. Volunteered at the UFC. Half my students volunteered at the UFC fights in the White House lawn, which I know people are paying attention to. That was, let me tell you something, guys, that was a scene. It was very entertaining and a lot of cool stuff. But we were all helping with the meet and greets of a lot of the fighters, which was a lot of fun on that. And worked in that. And we're ready to go. And, you know, we have a lot of projects in the fall. We're actually, funny enough, launching a podcast structure. We call it Kogod Live, that is updating our students on the news outlets. We have analysis now on our men's basketball team, women's basketball team, and soccer team now, which we're very excited about, our women's soccer team. So it's been a fun journey. If I can still integrate some of my sports betting and gaming world into a much bigger platform, you know, I think we're doing okay.
That's brilliant. I love it. That's great. It'll be, because what's great about it as well is it'll be your course is what they'll remember. Like when they look back on their university time, it'll be, this is what they'll remember.
You know, it's funny. I jokingly say when I'm in the classroom, I just tell stories and I explain to stuff about, like, you know, I shouldn't be saying this, but having a back room, a 21-year-old kid with $68,000 in a backpack, circumventing kiosks at a casino, and this kid says to me, I don't have a car to go home. And he's holding $68,000 in cash. I told my students, I said, I drive a Subaru Forester. I will give you my car. You have enough money in the bag. So, you know, things like that. They tell me that they love hearing the stories. They love hearing the things that and the real world experience. And I think, I think the gaming industry over the years, because it evolves so much, you know, you have our casino industry here in the States. You have a much bigger gaming industry internationally. But you have these, like, generational culture changes that happen over time. You have what I call, like, the old timer guys that would be playing poker in Vegas, that had the mobster connections, to the guys that were part of the corporations. Now these AI algorithmic guys that are betting on Polymarket and running these huge algorithms with thousands upon thousands of dollars to get a 2-3% advantage. Mm-hmm. Each generation, I think, passes on the stories and the excitement and the fun of, like, what was that time. And each increasing generation looks back and goes, wait, you guys did things like that? That was a thing? So it makes for just a very fun narrative that spans over time. And I think that younger individuals like to hear from what's happened in the past. Whereas for me, mob controlled Las Vegas is one of the biggest things that I love reading about, love understanding, you know, Hollywood has highlighted so many of those movies, but I look at that and I think that's fun. My kids look at my world and they say, like, that was really fun. And, you know, their kids are going to look back on this AI generation and say, okay, what in the world were you guys doing in the gaming industry and how much has it evolved?
Agreed.
So anyways, that was my, what I wanted to talk about the Royal Ascot, which was a very long circle way back to coming back to, the coolest thing we loved was, we had wagering money on, 10 Bob Tony. We didn't have, the horse winning the Queen Anne Stake on Tuesday, went off at a 50-1 long shot, won by a half a length, and actually is in now the Breeders' Cup, coming back to the States. So, it's a fun storyline. You have a 50-1 long shot, that one will be in the mile, October 30th, 31st at Keeneland. The world of that's, you want a big dichotomy, go from Royal Ascot Racecourse to Keeneland, Kentucky. Spoiler alert, they're not the same thing. they're not the same platform. Both are great and unique with their own cultural spin on it. And that's really fun. So that's going to be a fun horse to watch. My pick over everything was Bo Echo in the St. James Palace Stake. Won by, we're on a camera, so like, let's just say like a head bob, we'll call it. Half an inch head bob on that one. But that horse, for those that are in the European world, because I don't think the horse is coming over to the United States, dug down deep and had a great run in the last, I would probably call it, we use furlongs over here, so let's call it like meters. Last 200 meters and a half, just watching that horse run with I've Got Enough in the Tank to Kind of Win was a fun, you know, fun story. But one to pay attention to and to watch for in the coming months, Will Run Again is going to go off as a favorite, but worth it in a lot of your exacta and trifecta wagering, your superfectas or anything of your exotics, as there's a couple other ones that some of the Americans don't play over here. So that was kind of fun. And then the rest of the horses were really just like predictions of horses that we thought were going to do well and did well. And Ryan Moore won 7 races and, you know, has had another excellent and successful career. There's your Ryan Moore, whose father was a trainer. His 2 brothers are also jockeys. His sister was an amateur jockey champion. Like, you know, what do you do for dinner? Like, put all the kids outside and say like, okay, first one to the table gets like the big piece of meat or the big piece of chicken or something. So that was, you know, that was a really, those were just some really fun and exciting stories. You know, 10.65 million pounds in prize money this year at the Ascot. So again, richest meet in the British structure, which was fantastic. And yeah, it was a very fun event that had a couple of long shot upsets with a lot of things that we thought were going to be successful, and about 8 horses that, and I'll put up the list and I'll send you guys the list that you can put on the site, but a lot of horses that we'll get to see again in October that have a cool connection. And I want to mention the Royal Ascot because, see, here in America, we don't think that things happen anywhere else really outside of the United States. And I'll even back up. Here in America, we don't know that things happen like 5 miles down the road in other towns. We don't. So when the Breeders' Cup happens, a lot of the American handicappers and the I would call them the novice players, the casual fans, will sit there and go like, wait, that horse came from like Britain. That horse came from Ireland. That horse came from Japan, Australia. Like, but we're in Kentucky. Like, how did the horse get here? So I like to mention that there are fun storylines outside of the States that get to come over here. When I was in college, every year for the Breeders' Cup, I would have all the country's flags that were participating all in my dorm room. And every time we had an American horse win, my roommates and I, we'd have the American flag waving, and then we'd switch to the Irish flag, the Japan flag, the Australian flag. So we had all the flags set up, and you know, people looked at us like, you were really weird. What are you going to do with this? You're not going to make it a career. Hey, joke's on them. 10 years later, this is what I'm doing now. So, which is all to say that it was a fun meet, a financially successful meet, 2 cool long shots, and 2 horses with great stories that I think are going to come into the United States and make some noise on that one. Will those be horses that are part of my predictive model? Yeah, I think so. And was pretty excited about that. So, yeah, there was my recap from an American perspective who has a strong appreciation for international culture.
So golf is kind of your big. Sorry.
I've got a prediction question. So yes. John has been predicting for a while now that the American World Cup is going to be a really big deal.
John, I think he went out of constraints there on that one. I didn't get any of that.
No, it's just a coincidence that he was talking over me, and then his microphone just, because I can't mute any of you from here.
John's been predicting that the
World Cup. Done it again. Oh, this is thing is, Matt, that the recording is actually going to be perfect, I think.
Okay.
Am I not coming
so through? We're going to be laughing at nothing, and people are going to be here, Fintan, just speaking really clearly.
Am I not coming through?
Oh, try it again.
Am I back? Hello?
Hell, Fintan.
Knock, knock. No?
You're breaking up. It's like a bad, you know, late 1970s comedy star on British television.
Oh, shit. Okay. Let me...
It's very, very peculiar.
John, while Fintan works on his executive constraints, if you wanted to ask your question, then we can come back to that.
No, well, I was going to take you on to the golf, but I'm curious. Well,
I am curious on Finn's modeling question. Then we'll chat with my first love and passion, which I did get around in this morning. Two over par, one birdie, two bogeys, and one incident. We'll just go from there. There's a lot of geese on one of the holes this morning. We have a goose problem over here in the States with our golf courses. They love to just live there.
Well, the grass is nice.
This is true.
Like if I were something as big as a goose and I was like looking for somewhere to have a nice little lie down, I would totally go for the greens.
That's exactly what happens. And we have an island hole number 12. I played the back nine this morning at our course, and there's a giant pond around it, and the entire course is covered in just geese, and they're all sitting there, and I'm like sitting there like, well, I've got to make my putt, but I don't want these things to like just start flying everywhere and attacking me. So I walk on the hole very gingerly, and a couple of them sort of got up and were like, the vibe I got from the geese this morning were, we're gonna let you putt, but understand this is our territory. Like, we're allowing you here. So I had a moment with a couple of the geese that were like, we're gonna let you stay, but get out quickly.
In Florida, do they have issues with flamingos and alligators?
The gators, yes, actually. Speaking of your Newswire story, we actually have an alligator attack problem. We had a huge, it was on national news over here in the States. We had an alligator attack in Florida. That's the third one this week. We actually have a lot of alligator issues right now with beaches and with golf courses. I have no idea why. It's not very common. So the short answer, yes. And that's actually making American headlines right now.
Crazy. Fintan.
Am I back?
You are back.
You do seem to be clearer now. So give it a go. Go on.
Who knows? Probably my AI agents using up the RAM or something. Predictions. I've got a prediction question. John has been predicting that the World Cup is going to be a really big gambling event in America, or a really big event in America. This is like where soccer makes its mark in America. As boots on the ground, how is he doing so far?
Very, very interesting question. So we'll end, let's chat World Cup. We'll end with golf. Not that this isn't my show and I'm hijacking your theme, but that's a perfect segue into this. So you have to first start to answer that question with this concept of dynamic pricing that FIFA and the United States are starting. And when I use that, that sounds really technical. So we're going to break it down to the streets, scalpers and tickets and resale. Secondary market was huge for the World Cup this year. Or I should say the intent and the idea of the secondary market. So the World Cup FIFA pricing came in and said, we're going to price tickets a little bit higher than we normally would to try to eliminate the resale market. I teach this concept in class, and it's when you want somebody to buy something, you want 85% of your group to buy something. Because if 100% are buying that, you're not actually pricing it at the level that's going to maximize revenue. 85% purchase that. Mathematically, from an economic standpoint, that will actually make more money in the long term because of the higher cost. So what you're seeing is the results of the World Cup pricing strategy working financially. So the first part is the World Cup making money? Yes. Is it working financially? Absolutely. Are other businesses making money and being profitable on this? Yes. So that's the short answer. Mm-hmm. But this is kind of like an onion. You got to unpack the layers. So from the business perspective, is every host city making money and making the most amount of money? The answer is no. And the answer is no because of tourism infrastructure that was either established or not established. And I'll use two simple examples. LA. Everybody goes to LA, whether you're a sports person, a Hollywood person, or just I want to see it. LA has the ability, the means, and has hosted large-scale events and has a tourism infrastructure that's been established for years and decades. People know how to navigate around LA. It's already there. They have the hotel infrastructure. They have the movie scene. You get the idea. Seattle does not. Seattle's original prediction was around $865 million of profitability from the World Cup by being a host site, hosting events. They've actually lowered that estimate now from an economic standpoint to around $600 million, about a $200 million shortfall. So yes, they are being profitable, but not as profitable as was originally expected. LA, New York, Miami are the three cities that are thriving right now in the World Cup because they already have a tourism infrastructure established. Seattle and Boston, for example, while making money, while still hosting, we see stadiums that are about, you know, 75 to 80% capacity and not as much profit because they didn't have the tourism infrastructure that was available. It kind of comes down to this one conclusion. Just being a host site didn't guarantee you this big mega financial boom. What you needed were a couple layers that were underneath that. And that's what I've been talking about in the last 2 weeks outside of, you know, the matchups and the betting stuff from my business perspective, putting my management faculty hat on, was it's not evenly distributed. So is it going to be big here in America? Or I should say, is it big? Absolutely. Are we having great watch parties? Fantastic. But peeling it back, you're going to have winners on the business side. You're going to have losers on the business side. And you're going to have people rethinking, like, is it worth me hosting a mega event? Is it worth me being this host site? Is it worth me bringing this in? Is it worth me doing like this particular capacity? Is my city available with the infrastructure to be successful? What's that going to have an implication on? The Women's World Cup next year, future host sites of the Olympics. If the United States or other countries are going to look at this model and say, okay, if we don't have the tourism infrastructure, it's not going to work for us financially and profitability. So to scale it all back, yes, there's good stuff and bad, but it's unequal. And then from a fan perspective, with this dynamic pricing structure that's been established, you're sacrificing fan loyalty for profitability. Mm. And that has been a very polarizing issue here in the United States, being a very, we are a cap. And I know we talked about this very specifically in the last podcast that we did. We're a very capitalistic country and we're profitability driven. It's, you know, how America works for the right or wrong. You have people that will sit there and go, look, if people are willing to spend more money on this, they're willing to spend more money on this. It is what it is. You have others that are saying, but you're pricing out the casual, or not the casual fan, the diehard fan that can't afford it. You have people that are on both sides of the aisle on this one. Some are saying it's not fair. Others are saying, hey, listen, if somebody's willing to pay, what it's leading to is your bigger matchups, your bigger teams, your bigger clubs will have the full stadiums. Your lighter clubs are having stadiums filled between 75 and 80% of capacity and having a little bit of a ticket issue. And then it's getting at this bigger question. Are you losing fan loyalty? And to sum all that up, though, what has been saving the United States in that debate is Team USA's success. You know, the final matchup, they rest all the players. I'm throwing that whole entire thing out. But winning the first two matchups 4-1, 2-1, doing exactly what we're supposed to do. We have, according to my model, we have an 82.3% of winning and getting into the round of 16, 45.3% of getting into the quarterfinals, 17.1% of getting into the semis. So one thing about American sports is the more you win, the more excitement you get. Everybody forgets about all this business nonsense and ticketing loyalty and comes back to, hey, we're winning, we're good, we don't care. So that was a great question that I took way too long to answer and threw a lot of stuff out at you.
it's a really, I loved your, I think my question was actually really basic. You've answered a much better question. Because it you're right. It's one, like, see, if you think of like Olympics and you think of other World Cups and stuff, like the London Olympics was fantastic, but it's in a city with full tourism infrastructure where people are, you know, excited to go visit London. Or if you look at the last World Cup, you know, it's a lot of, you know, stadiums built for this event in places where you probably wouldn't go anyway. So you're literally just going for, you know, you go for the game and you leave immediately. So you're not getting those kind of benefits. So it's actually, you know, because there is a huge issue with these major sporting, like a World Cup or an Olympics, where they're just massive white elephants. You know, huge costs, zero, like basically, you know, the forecast is always a lie. The economic benefit is always a lie and the costs are massively understated. But pairing it with places where people, so basically the bigger, more tourist driven places are just going to get bigger.
Exactly.
Like, you know, you can kind of see Las Vegas just trying to build that into their model 24/7 of just like, we've got so much stuff on, you've got to visit Vegas.
Well, you know, people had a big debate about Vegas bringing an NHL team. They said, look, Vegas is a transient community. It has people coming in and out. Are they going to be receptive to an NHL team? And the Golden Knights, of course, you know, have had nothing but success with not only winning, being back in the Stanley Cup. We saw that with the Las Vegas Aces coming in. We now saw this with the Las Vegas Raiders and then soon to be the, we don't know the team name yet, but we're thinking Athletics. We'll see. But why is it working? Because yes, it is a tourism destination, but it has everything around there to be successful and to support the community. So, you know, it's a new model we're now looking at. One that we funny enough, teach. It'll be a class in 2027. We call it Mega Events. We're teaching a World Cup class right now. Professor Matt Winkler teaches that. And then we're going to move that and merge that into in the spring of understanding the business behind Mega Events.
Got it. So then from a sports perspective then, so they're, you know, the Americans, you know, sports fans are getting behind the World Cup, are, you know, because obviously it helps that the team's winning, but it is actually, you know, when I think of soccer in America, I always think of that Homer Simpson joke of I nearly saw a goal.
There's a great Simpsons episode where it's Portugal and Spain are playing in the they basically try to combine Monday Night Football's theme over here with soccer, and they watch the commercial and they're like, "Why have you never taken us to a soccer match, Dad?" He's like, "I don't know." And the segment actually goes to the American commentator going halfback passes to center, center to halfback, halfback to center. Holding, and they go to the Portugal commentator or the Spanish commentator. He's like, it's the center, holding, he's hot. And it's so you're not wrong. You're an analogy. Okay.
So to break down is it resonating with Americans?
Yes. And there's a few reasons why. There's four main reasons, and I will do this in no particular order. Number one, we have absolutely nothing to gamble on right now. We have baseball. Americans tend not to. Baseball is one of the sports that we bet the least amount on in terms of wagering. And one of the reasons why is there's just game after game. It's hard, even with money on the game, to be emotionally invested in a baseball game. It just operates differently. It's a bit slower. There's so many of them. There's a lot of moving parts. Whereas football is once a week. It's the same team. Things tend to be very repetitive. There's only 18 weeks of it. So we need something to gamble on, and we need something to gamble on because since 2018 and really the explosion of sports betting over here, we have millions upon millions of people wagering. So that's been one thing why there's been attention on it. It's one game, it's one matchup, that's the whole part. So Americans are embracing it for reason number one. There is an opportunity to bet on something other than baseball at this time period. We have no other real sports going on right now. So that's kind of your first component. Your second component where the embrace has been coming in is we, in the last really 8 years of the country, from our political structure, have been extremely polarized. We've been both positive and negative on the international scene with multiple countries. And I don't need to get into the world of the details of the news. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. You know, America has been very polarized internally, politically, and on the international scale. This has been a chance for people that are really, and I call it, when I say well-educated, I don't mean like going to a lot of school, but, you know how to put a political question or a quorum aside to watch a game with someone that has a different opinion. And in this case, they're rooting for a different country. You have a lot of camaraderie and you have a lot of mixed cities here in the United States with people that come from all different types of countries. It's very similar to, and I can't believe I'm comparing this, but the United States did this with China with ping pong. And we went over to China during the Nixon administration. See, it all came back to that 1971-72 election I was talking about before. I was going somewhere with this. But we went over there to kind of just sort of have this conversation of culture and, you know, have a dialogue between the United States and another country, in this case, China. So you're seeing people going to watch parties, going and watching other countries and talking with other colleagues because you work with people from these other countries. You have something that's not as polarizing, not a news thing, not an economic thing, not a political thing. It's watching a ball go in a net. It's a really easy thing to sit there and have a pint with a guy watching a ball go in a net and talk about what's on the field, then debate over economic and trade war policy. So, and I say this because am I a little biased from being in DC? Sure, but I'm also from New England. I'm seeing it in Boston. I was in New York for one of the matches. I saw it in New York, seeing it in Miami, seeing it in, you know, in California, in Texas, in Seattle, all cities that have a diverse economic population and, you know, national population. So that's been a very big, you know, run of into what we've seen on the American side. So those are kind of the two reasons why it's taking off and why it's kind of going. Your third is there's been a heavy investment in youth movement from an advertisement perspective, meaning watch World Cup, get your kids involved in World Cup. There's summer camps around World Cup. There's club teams. There's been a heavy investment financially in the United States of getting youth involved in this sport, and they're centering it around this whole entire marketing strategy. So what does that mean? A kid is currently at soccer camp right now or on a premier team while watching the World Cup, while being supported financially by these clubs and these partnerships and private equity as an investment in growing the game from a youth perspective and a youth sport perspective. So that's kind of been, you know, why it's been sort of driven on this side. And finally, from a media attention wise here, we can watch every single game on Peacock. We can watch every single game at a watch party. We can watch. There are so many viewing platforms and availabilities to see what's going on that it's almost hard not to miss that. So you've got your media attention, a push for youth sports, a sporting structure that is cutting away from geopolitical issues and culture, and something to bet on. Four drivers that are pushing this from the, for, you know, into the United States. Are they, you know, prediction wise? They predicted the ratings a little too high. Yeah. Did they predict too much money was going to be made? Yes. But still 10%, 20% lower, in my opinion, is still successful.
I think I've just been pondering, like, sometimes when a nation hosts an event, the event lives on beyond the host's participation. Now you've got three countries jointly hosting, which is, you know, Mexico is football mad. Canada is, I'm sorry, what's that round thing? And the USA is kind of getting there. You know, your league seems to be sustaining itself. But I think, and I couldn't have made this call before the tournament, but I think that even if the US get knocked out, the tournament will still have legs domestically because the superstars have delivered and are continuing to deliver. Harry Kane has had a very decent World Cup so far. Erling Haaland has shown up. Messi is ripping up the fucking records. Mbappe is sparkling, but the whole France team is sparkling. You know, the big, big names have turned up. There are some big score lines in unexpected places. And as of the early hours of this morning, two of the traditional big names have gone out, which kind of, I've been saying for ages that if it ain't France that wins it, it will be some absolute dark horse. Mm-hmm. But that gate just got thrown wide open last night with the exit of the Netherlands, who I know haven't been any great shakes lately, but historically they have a stunning pedigree and it's a really talented group of players. But Germany going out
on penalties as well, which is like the German.
Yes. Which, listen, so don't get me, that. Do not get me started on. Okay, I will look. I'm gonna rant for a second. Then we're gonna go into futures market because Finn made that penalties comment. Confer Cup, I watched every single match. And I kid you not, I was running the sports book. We had a 60-inch TV in front of me. I watched every match. And it was just a historically significant amount of penalty, like rounds ended in penalties or teams got knocked out in penalties. I think there was like 12 or 13 matches where it went to penalty kicks. And I was sitting there as very typical, stereotypical American going, you play 100 and something minutes running on here and end it with penalty kicks. Like, it's one of the few things that I have a hard time getting behind in the sport. And I 100% blame American culture and my American upbringing in this, going, you spend all this time running around and putting all this energy in, and you're going to end it with like kicking at a goal. Hockey had one of the very similar problems here in the United States with ties. We don't like ties here. So they went to a shootout. Okay. That was fine. It was exciting on that stuff. But what they modified their overtime for, it's 3-on-3 hockey. So a lot of the matchups end up actually finishing in 3-on-3. And I've said, why can't they adopt that same thing into football where go 8-on-8, open up the space, go 4-on-4 for 10 minutes as an overtime segment for a little bit more excitement than going to the penalty kicks. I don't know if I'm hoping someone convinces me why that's a proper way to end a match. I don't know.
I love the penalty shootouts.
Did you see the Germany-Paraguay shootout?
I know, don't get me wrong, I love the excitement of it. I just feel so bad that that's the way the match ends after doing all that on the pitch, you know, and that's how the match ends. And it's like, why don't we just start with this?
Which is, it's really interesting psychologically watching a penalty shootout.
Oh, no doubt. My best friend, Amanda Dennis, she's Lieutenant Dennis in our Coast Guard now, played 4 years at Penn State, Women's National Soccer League, was the goalkeeper. And when there'd be penalty shots, I'd talk to her about it all the time. Like, what does that go through? What is that like? I mean, one of the most exciting things to watch and then to speak to the goalie and get the perspective on it at the collegiate ranks was something. So it was, oh, you're exactly right.
Well, Paraguay used to have a goalkeeper called, I think it was Jose Luis Chilavert, who was an expert dead ball taker, an amazing free kick taker, goalkeeper, one of the highest scoring goalkeepers that's ever played the game. I think he's second highest scoring goalkeeper. But unfortunately, they didn't have him last night. Well, I mean, it would have been a shorter penalty shootout if they'd had him. But it was, I think Germany missed 3 penalties out of 6. I say missed, saved or missed. And it was really fascinating because some big names fluff their penalties. And these are highly experienced players. These are big game players. These aren't, you know, 17-year-olds that have come into the side. These are, yeah. I mean, Kai Havertz, who took the first German penalty, which was unsuccessful, he scored the winning goal in the Champions League final for Chelsea. Now, I mean, he's a big game dude. And it's like it emphasizes what an absolute lottery penalties are, because even the biggest names, the most cold, steely-eyed, shark-faced strikers can really fuck it up. And that's why I love it. If you go out on penalties, if you lose on penalties, it's, do you know what? If you lose on penalties, there is zero shame in that. Because anything can happen, as we saw last night. That Paraguay shoot. So like Fenton. So Germany, first penalty unsuccessful. That was Kai Havertz, and I love Havertz. I'm a big fan. So that was Havertz, right? So Germany took the first penalty. Paraguay scored theirs. Germany scored their second. Paraguay scored their second. Germany scored their third. Paraguay scored their third. So you got 3-2 with 2 penalties left. Anyway.
Attention.
But then Paraguay fluffed their next 2 penalties. And it was extraordinary. It's like you just needed to score one of those because Germany fluffed another one. There was a tremendous. Also, in Germany, Manuel Neuer was in goal, one of the greatest goalkeepers of the last 30 years. He's a tremendous goalkeeper. Does a beautiful save. When he does that save, and it's a fantastic save, when he does that save, you think, oh, shit, here we go. Here we go. Well, the commentators are going to start trotting out lines like, oh, these Germans, they've been terribly efficient, haven't they? It's shit like that. But he made, and they still went out. Oh, it was good. That's why I was so tired. After I dropped the kids off this morning, I went back to bed for a nap because I stayed up to watch that. It's really bad. Sorry.
So I will say this. And then I do have to mention something about golf at some point. This is a good connection to what is, of course, the theme of the show of gambling is the futures markets now. With all the excitement and storylines of the top dogs going out, we especially here in the United States, specifically with Caesars right now, and with a little bit of concern at DraftKings, America put a lot of money on Team USA. Most of it was nostalgic bets, like, put money on Team USA. Most thought Team USA wasn't going to go that far. However, they wanted to be part of the action. And yes, mathematically, they only have a 2.6% chance of winning the World Cup. That's, you know, what it comes down to. However, in the futures market, what a lot of people don't understand, the whole percentage is very different than the whole percentage of an individual match. In most cases, a sports book will have a whole percentage of between 4% and 5%. You know, so all the money goes out, one side wins, you pay the other side, the book keeps 4% to 5%. Now, the actual official number of a futures market has a bit of a wider range, but most individuals will accept a 20 to 30% range on most futures bets, meaning who's going to win X championship, the Premier League, the Super Bowl, the World Cup, whatever that's going to be. And it's sportsbooks love it because it's very profitable for them. It's a 20 to 30% takeout versus your traditional 4 to 5%. And as long as your favorites or top teams tend to perform and win, it becomes very lucrative. What you run into, though, and this is a very fun storyline that I am loving following right now, is when your top dogs go out, a Germany loss, for example, you now have a business model that if one of your, as you said, dark horses come through and win, is going to be very crushing for sports books. Now, US has, as I said, a 2.6% chance of winning the World Cup this year. However, Caesar's staff is quoted right now saying that if the Team USA would win, it would go down in history as the biggest financial loss for Caesar's sportsbook in the history of gambling, which is pretty cool. Not, you know, we don't want to seem to go out of business or anything like that, because then how would I make a living? But from a perspective, though, of that storyline, that's pretty significant. So what I think is also going to draw a lot of attention is going to be Matt Birkendyke, by the way, said that his exact quote was, "The U.S. is by far the worst result in the book, specifically because of tournament patriotic money," as he's calling it, plus very good, successful early performance. And if it's lost, could be the biggest loss Caesars has ever experienced on a soccer tournament in the history of gambling. Very cool on that. So anyways, I say this because this is also going to be a very interesting storyline now being added into the world of the World Cup. And from an American perspective, while we all love to gamble, while we all love to be part of this world, while it's taken off and it's, you know, been exponential growth predicted until 2030 here in the States, one thing we love more than winning money is watching a sportsbook lose money. So you're going to have so many casual fans not only rooting for the U.S. because, you know, we love America, it's America's 250th birthday, XYZ, blah, blah, blah. They want to see the sportsbook go down. They want to see this. They kind of have this like David versus Goliath kind of mentality of the little guy, the better never wins. Are they going to take down the house? Look, do I'm if I play my, put my math card on here and my statistical card on here. Yeah. USA 2.5, 2.6% chance of being champion. It's probably not going to happen. If I put my sports fan hat on, I'd love to see a run.
There's a chance. There's a percentage chance. There's a chance.
Exactly. So, you know, but it goes back to a business model that sportsbooks now really have to start to wrestle with. Years and years ago, when you didn't have as many options or you had a very solid European model that wasn't really mainstream in the United States because of the offshore books, you could sustain a loss at an underdog winning a championship. But now with the amount of money that's involved, an underdog winning a championship is a huge, significant business impact to an industry that is already, you know, only looking at a 4% or 5% profitability growth every year because of how the model works. And so many players at the, you know, at the stage or players in the field, in a sense, like there's multiple different companies, there's multiple different websites. There's so many people looking for that slice of pie of revenue that you take a loss, it could be very significant. And that's going to play out. And I'm very curious how that works, because I will tell you right now, Americans love that patriotic money. Growing up here in New England, we have, of course, the New England Patriots. Yes, we're very original. We just put new in front of everything over here in the States. But this year, nobody thought the Patriots were going to make the Super Bowl. They were plus 7,500 to even make the game. But working at a sports book in New England, everybody comes in over the course of 6 or 7 months and goes, "Give me $100 on the Patriots. You never know. Give me $100 on the Patriots. You never know." Patriots were plus 7,500. Seattle was plus 7,200. Those were the Super Bowl teams this year. It was a big hit. And now you have this kind of same thing.
Did they not learn anything from Leicester City? Because in the UK, after Leicester City won the Premiership, nobody gives 5,000 to 1 odds on any team winning the Premier League anymore. It just doesn't happen.
Patriots, I believe, were 2-2 at the time, and Seattle was 1-2, and were at the start of the season, and it was the best financial backing for that. So no, to answer your question, no. This is my one prediction for individuals. We saw this in 2021, 22 in the States with the Baltimore Orioles. The Washington Nationals opened up the year at plus 100,000 to 1 to win the World Series. Okay, they dropped all the way down to 50,000 to 1. They're still holding at 50,035. The team right now is 43-43 or 43-42, depending on last night. I forget to look. We lost to the Red Sox. Everybody thought they'd be out. Baltimore was in the same boat. It got to the end of August, and Baltimore was in a position where they were like a game out of the wild card, and had an actual chance of winning the World Series. And everybody had these futures bets. We're like literally writing articles, sweating. My one prediction is, do I think Washington's going to win the World Series? Nope, but it's a hell of a hedge bet right now. If they continue their hot bats for another month and a half, that plus 50,000 would go down to a significant amount of money to where now you have some fun times and some fun plays. So no, we haven't learned. And is there value out there in the betting market? Absolutely.
Yeah, just some $10 bets. You're like, and that's the mortgage paid.
On the because obviously the Caesars putting out the press release is good marketing, right? It's easy coverage.
Of course it is.
And Caesars being at risk of losing the most they've ever lost on a soccer game doesn't actually mean it's going to be a significant financial hit compared to any given Sunday type thing, right?
Correct.
Is there actually that much being wagered on the World Cup?
We won't know the final figures. I can only say from a predictive standpoint, there's two trends that I've observed in the last 6 years being in the industry. One is people want to gamble and they'll bet on anything. Case in point, I mentioned this at the beginning, Russian ping pong at 3 o'clock in the morning. That's what's on. Let's get some money in that. So you do have people that want to be involved with nothing else to bet. So that's kind of a pathway. You also have a lot of individuals that are already coming off of, I used to wager on, you know, we just had the March Madness tournament, we had the Super Bowl, we had the NFL playoffs. I was a new customer, kind of want to be part of that. So I venture to guess the answer is yes. I think whatever estimate that comes out might be a little bit less than whatever's being estimated right now. We'll have to see kind of what goes on from there.
Yeah. And I suppose we could just look at the prediction markets as well in terms of audience ratings. So
90, I want to say it was 11 billion right now. 11.9 billion wagered on prediction markets at this time. So, you know, perfect example of.
Does that include the buy and the sell?
I don't know. I'm only going off of figures that were reported by NBC in their Sunday breakdown, and it was 11.9. I think what the 11.9 is sort of total revenue volume that's kind of gone through. Mm.
Okay. Interesting.
Nice. But it makes for a fun storyline. And so does of course the world of golf.
It's good PR. It's good PR.
Exactly.
Yeah, it the key word in what Matt cited Caesars as saying was, of course, in a football tournament. It's like, yeah, they're probably not paid that much out, but this is a big tournament for gambling in the US, Fintan. Wait and see.
I look at Matt's agreeing with you.
I'm looking forward to I'm looking forward to how this is going to play out. And look, if the United States happens to pull off a win, that'd be kind of cool. I'll also mention this though. My favorite meal to eat is fish and chips. It's always been like that. It is my favorite food item of all time. And when England and the United States ever get together or there's World Cup matches, that's usually my bet. So one of two things tends to happen. I either get a free fish and chip dinner or I have to buy one for somebody, but it doesn't matter because I still get to eat my favorite meal. So my wagering a lot of times with people when it is involving England and the United States in any type of World Cup thing is a fish and chip dinner. So I'm hoping to catch a few of those.
Do you know what my usual bet is on the World Cup, right? Almost every tournament they've qualified for since about 94, I think, certainly since 98, probably starting in the 98 tournament, I've bet on Mexico to win the World Cup.
Okay.
And this tournament I didn't.
What?
And they've been flying.
Mate, the World Cup's famous for home team advantage as like a influencing factor.
Canada have slipped up there, haven't they? Because Canada came second in their group, so they've lost home advantage. But
yeah,
like,
but you're still,
I just
if you're Canadian and you're in America. Like
the thing is, part of the host team advantage. You got to think about this, right? There's host team advantage, but is part of that the fact that you didn't have to go through a very demanding set of qualifying ties? Are you just a bit better rested?
No, I think it's basic stuff like, you know, the food, right time zone, you've acclimatized.
I don't doubt that that's all part of it. I don't doubt that that's all part of it.
Fan engagement.
But the further they go in the tournament, they're not going to be playing in Mexico.
For sure, but I think there's an advantage, like the Mexican team in most, like if Mexico are playing in Miami, that's still a
Dude, nobody's going to turn up. There'll be ICE officers in the car park.
It'd be a really bad tailwind.
They'll be at the train stations, at the bus stations. It will be the quietest stadium in the tournament.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
As somebody who lives in Washington, D.C., I'm skeptical. I think it's going to be loud. It's going to be ruckus.
I
hope so.
There'll be too many people. There'll be just too many people to potentially arrest. Like, it'll be impossible.
Wait and see.
I think if Mexico run deep, you're not going to stop Mexican fans.
Knowing how things have been done by certain administrations, which will go nameless, it's not out of the question for the entire Mexico squad to be arrested.
Listen, one thing I've said, I'm not surprised at anything that happens over here anymore. The shock and awe factor of the United States has now been eliminated.
There was a point made by Gary Lineker, who, for anybody listening who's not that familiar, he was a famous English striker and he's been a TV host on the main football program for fucking, I don't know, 20 years. He made a really interesting point. He said, this is the first World Cup where one of the competing nations has been at war with the host nation. And I'm like, holy shit, he's right. He's absolutely 100% right.
Technically, we can't classify it as a war. It's a conflict. Let's talk golf.
Yeah, let's not talk semantics. Let's talk golf.
I am super pumped about now I knew it growing up as the British Open, but it has now been rebranded to the Open Championship because for obvious reasons, it's not just in Britain. So this year's 154th Open Championship, Royal Birkdale, that'll be the 11th time it's being a host site for that, July 16th to the 26th. And there's some fun storylines that I think are going to play out here, both from a casual fan perspective and some really good value on the betting market that'll kind of come into the golf world. We went through my background last time. Undergrad at Penn State University in golf management, PGA affiliation. So golf, you know, played this morning and chased some geese. These were always the big, you know, things we watched. And working as a golf professional for a number of years, it was always a big thing. Everybody asked questions like, who's going to win? Who's going to win? And I'd always say, like, look, there's a lot of golfers out there. I'm not going to tell you who's going to win because that's always hard. But I can at least give you some fun individuals to watch for and what are some cool storylines and some nice long shots to take a look at. So that was my thought process when I was looking at that. But I've always been a fan of the Open and the links style courses across the pond because it's a different form of golf. You know, America, we're very park line. And for those that don't understand the difference, park line is, you know, a hole that's surrounded by trees, just a straight fairway. Think of a runway on a plane. You're hitting straight to the right or to the left and surrounded by trees. Links, wide open, huge effect by the wind. Pot style bunkers, giant circles that are extreme, like next to impossible to get out, where you're sitting over at Muir Field and you're hitting your shot for the fourth time in a tournament and want to hurl your club at the cameraman, but can't because you know you'll be banned from Muir Field and kicked out. True story, in my opinion, right there. Made a 9 in that hole that day. It's a fun, different atmosphere for us to take a look at, and I'm excited for this year's Open. So, of course, the question you want to ask is, what did you put together in your algorithm and how did you bet it? So here's what I did. This was my breakdown. I looked at a bunch of different categories and we weighed the model at different percentages. So 20 coming in at the highest weight was at 22%. What is the betting market signal? Meaning what are the actual crowds and individuals betting on? If you look at and read any of the last gambling books in the last 5 years, many people will tell you that the crowd factor is a factor in betting and is usually intends to be correct, which is why we have favorites, which is why we have that structure. So you have to take into account where is all the money going and why do people think this team is going to win. Prediction markets have shown us this. There's a 72% chance of this happening. The crowd has shown this kind of factor. So look at 22% of what the market is going, meaning that takes on a weight. 20% of my model looks at the current form of the player and their FedEx Cup position, meaning how well are they doing right now? Are they on the up? Are they ranked? Where are they ranked in the FedEx Cup across the board? 17% of the model looked at major championship resumes, players who have either won majors and are less likely, as I call it, this my exact writing is players who have contended or won majors and are less likely to be overwhelmed by Sunday pressure, wind, or chaos. I use chaos because last year, Travelers Championship is our home course here in Connecticut. It's about 20 miles up the road. And they had a bunch of guys run on the field at 18 and like throw smoke things that spray the smoke on the 18.
Is the Travelers one the one at the end? It was like the big amphitheater at the end where everyone's just drinking?
Yes, it's like
a massive party. Like, is that Travelers?
You're thinking of TPC Scottsdale. That's the 16th hole. Yes, that happens. But also, we're all drinking. We're just not as rowdy. Same amphitheater, same hole finish, same structure. Just not as rowdy in Connecticut. The Waste Management Open. Yeah, that's the rowdy one. Yes. Okay. So that's 70% of the model. Are your playing styles a fit to what I call it the Birkdale fit or a Link style type of golf course? And what we're rewarding is trajectory, control, patience, the ability to lag putt. I looked at the stat of lag putting because those greens are huge. It's not the same traditional American greens. And bunker avoidance. Are you staying out of those terrible bunker sands? I looked at their ball striking techniques from TrackMan technology and course fit profile, driving control. Basically, can you keep the ball in the fairway and not 50 feet to the right or left? Short game putting, 6%. Volatility in weather. As I'm sure you guys are much more familiar than I am, it's not a typical weather day over up in that area. It's not the typical weather day. And then health, rest, and schedule narrative at 4%. So those are my probability models that I took into account and factoring in. And what did that tell me? Okay, it told me a very standard thing that we all think is pretty common. One of the top world ranking players, Scottie Scheffler, my model says has a 14.8% chance of winning. Right behind them, him at 11%, 11.8% is Rory McIlroy. Okay, these make sense. John Rahm coming in at 6.7%. Here's my betting value, fan favorite, love him. Watched him play last year up here in Connecticut. Heartbreaking loss to Keegan Bradley. Tommy Fleetwood at 6.1%. Right around plus 1500 to win the tournament. Fun fan person, individual who is coming in with some experience on the international scale. Xander Schauffele at 6%. Matt Fitzpatrick coming off a strong day one, day two opening of the U.S. Open, then faltering. If I want a good pick for a day one successful person or a cash out or potentially like making the top, you know, Matt Fitzpatrick, excellent. Kind of long shot on that one. And then the rest kind of come in at that 4% kind of ranking across the board on that one. So my top five, Scottie, Rory, John Rahm, Tommy Fleetwood, Xander Schauffele, Matt Fitzpatrick are all ones that like, who's going to win? I have a high predictive value that's going to be our group looking at Sunday. If I get four of the six of those, I'd be very happy with that.
But golf odds are quite not generous, but like there's like, you can bet on a range of golfers and still be plus EV for the weekend, right?
Yes, you can. Not only that, you can bet on golfers in the top five, top 10, and top 20 finishes as well. Oh, okay. So there's tons of value in a golfer winning, a golfer finishing the top five, the top 10. So Jordan Spieth, for example, is not even on my leaderboard of a golfer that could win, but he won it in 2017. He's had some up and down roller coaster success. He's a bit of a long shot, but that's a perfect bet of like, I've won it in 2017. I've been here before. I know the course. I've been playing good. I've been playing bad. I'm kind of rocking back and forth. Jordan finishing in the top 10, high value on that in terms of odds. You're probably going to get a plus 2000, if not maybe about a 2000 plus 2500 on your money line odds there, which would be great. Shane Lowry is another long shot that prediction on the win, but top five, top 10. I very much like that one. Minwoo Lee as well. Huge variance upside play, roller coaster drama that I kind of like on that one. But my best long shot actually is Chris Goddard. He's at plus 4,000 right now, but his in my algorithm actually has one of the best successful plans. If I look at all these factors to actually have some success on that. So you know, what's my best fan story and best, like, I want to get a bet in because I want to be part of the action and, like, you know, be a local person, see things on that one. Tommy Fleetwood or Jordan Spieth, my best person to, like, shake up those top sixes, Shane Lowry. And my best outright winner at the highest value is Chris Gotterup. And I think we're going to see okay. So, like, Matt, you're throwing all this out there. How did you do on the Masters? I had the top five. I had four of the top five golfers in the Masters last year. That model, very profitable, very successful, using some of the same strategies over here. The really big thing I like is, where do you stand with your major championship resume? Have you been there before? So I like that kind of stuff. That's my breakdown looking at that, where I see really strong value across the board, and why I think we're going to see a couple of good things happen over there, and who I think is going to be there on Sunday.
All right.
And I'll throw one more name out at you. Sam Burns. Sam Burns is at plus 6,000 right now on Bet365. But he finished runner up in the US Open over here. So the man is playing quite well right now, is a person that's sitting kind of in that range. I don't hate the odds and the structure on that. So that's what it comes down to. But kind of going back to what I started with at the end of just putting things together from this weighing model of what I think is going to work and seeing how it comes out and kind of testing back and forth. This will be just another fun lesson in the classroom of, guys, take multiple variables, run statistical correlations and see if it works, and then kind of put this together. We're going to run the same model, not from a betting purpose, but from our men's basketball team, and figure out what are some of our more efficient locations on the court for taking shots at that lead us the highest value and the highest points. So, but I get to wrap it around golf and something that I love. And I'm looking forward to, you know, a bunch of fun storylines. The fun thing to do, if you really want to entertain your friends though, with the Open Championship, is there's a time difference. So they have the live, you know, what's going on early in the morning. And they also have the replay. So in the evening over here in the States, go watch with your friends and tell them a bunch of things that you already know are going to happen. And they'll think you're a genius predicting how the course is going to go, because it's already on a time delay. And most people won't pay attention to that in the late hours. So I've always used that joke from time to time on that end. And my golf tip. Okay, everybody goes, Matt, you're a PGA pro. How do you hit out of those giant pop bunkers? What do you do? What do I do for that? The biggest tip I give everybody is, you're taking your hands on your backswing and literally trying to take your hands and push them into the sky. So instead of a elongated high arc backswing, it's taking the hands and raising them extremely high in the air, like you're punching the sky, sort of a direct reach up and chop down at the bunker on that one. That's going to give you your most loft. So most golfers, when they're in their amateur states, will just take this elongated backswing, kind of, I'm going to come out super far, big arc. What you really want to do is a short, compacted backswing that almost goes straight up in the air and comes straight down in a slicing motion. That'll get you the most loft and get you out of those pop bunkers for when you do your business trips over there and play St. Andrews and all those courses and Jubilee and stuff.
Noted. I'll write that down. Thank you.
How is your golf coming on, Fintan?
Not so good. Not so good. I was doing lessons, and then work and life got in the way, and I haven't been doing any more lessons, so I've not. But my brother-in-law came over, and he's an avid golfer, and he took my son out, and they went and played a round of golf, and they had a great day. So my son, I've caught him watching golf now in his bedroom. So he's getting, I know, yeah, it's like, nerd.
You know, one nice thing I've said about the game of golf is there's very few sports that you can play. There's two things about golf that I very much love. One, it's a sport that you usually carry your entire life with. Once you learn it, it kind of stays with you. And because of the handicap and scoring system, it's one of the few sports that you can play against anyone in a competitive manner. You know, I can't go on a basketball court and play in the NBA, but I can give my brother 6 or 7 strokes for handicap purposes and match up. And because of tee box structure, play him in a competitive manner where we're both putting our biggest effort in to try to be successful in that matchup. And you don't see that too often in sports. So I've always had a passion about that, because it's very inclusive and it's something that stays with you the rest of your life. So when you tell stories like that, I'm always happy to hear somebody taking on the game early, because it's usually something that sticks with them for a long time.
He had a great day. Good. It's it really resonated, and it's his uncle and stuff as well, so he loves it. It was really nice.
Amazing. Well, you should probably get back out there, Fintan.
I know. I've just got to find the time. I'm just too busy, executive. But anyway, Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks for having me. I love the humor with you guys and the conversation. So I appreciate you guys having me on and letting me pick your brain for about an hour and a half on some of the things that I'm really passionate about. And hopefully get to see you in 2027 when we come over with Absolutely. Our students in
That'd
March.
That'd be great.
And looking forward to some more stuff here in the States for our official launch of our sports management program in fall 2026.
Brilliant.
Although very happy with where we stand right now.
Brilliant. Well done.
Good luck with that.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you, Matt. If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.